Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Judith Newman on the twists and turns in Downton Abbey.
It's not a question of the characters, but they need to know what the characters do and how the characters act and what the difference is between a first footman and a second footman.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Liesl Schillinger discusses Elizabeth Taylor's career as a screen feminist.
Elizabeth Taylor did such larger-than-life, larger-than-typical restrained womanhood roles on the screen that it's more like she embodied a larger, freer kind of femininity than she was even aware she was doing.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Well, unless you've been living in a cave, or maybe especially if you're living in a cave, you know all about the British import television sensation Downton Abbey. There are many new books about it, and we asked a great cultural journalist, Judith Newman, to look at three of them and illuminate this attractive world for us. So I'm delighted Judith's here to talk about these books. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Tannenhaus.
Oh, she's so formal. So, Judith, there are many, many books. We chose three because this television show has just spawned a kind of companion literary industry. As Julie Bosman reported in the paper, people who watch PBS are likely to read books as well. So we gave you three of them, and maybe you can walk us through them. The first one is The World of Downton Abbey. Is that kind of a companion guide to the series?
It is a companion guide and a very successful one because there's a sense that Americans need to know a little bit about the protocol of a place like Downton Abbey. It's not a question of the characters, but they need to know what the characters do and how the characters act and what the difference is between a first footman and a second footman. And so for all of us who did not have the benefit of growing up in a castle, this is the book that teaches us about that, as well as just, you know, introducing us to the gorgeous, lush characters in the story.
And Judith, for people who haven't seen the program, some may remember Upstairs, Downstairs. It's the life of extremely well-to-do, privileged British gentry, and also the people who look after them and how those lives intersect.
That's right.
Two of the books you looked at is that you read for us and discuss in your essay also come at that whole issue of class divisions and distinctions in Great Britain. There's one called Lady Almina and the Real Downton Abbey. Why the real Downton Abbey?
Well, essentially, this introduces us to the real people who lived there during this Edwardian time that Downton Abbey is supposed to take place in. Lady Almina is and was a very young woman known as the Pocket Venus of her time. And she was a beauty, and she made Highclere Castle the social epicenter of Edwardian England. So she was somewhat of an originator in that too, because the whole idea that we've grown up on Bertie Wooster and Jeeves and the idea of weekend parties, well, it really originated with her, and it originated with the Count's parents as well. So it tells the story of the people who lived there at the time that allegedly Downton Abbey was based on. However, there's a lot of question about whether the Countess's rendition of this world is quite the true one. Some of the story told, but in that wonderful aristocratic way, there is some whitewashing.
And does that mean then that the program we're watching is sort of loosely based on these actual events, but many liberties
loosely,
taken?
Loosely, because those of us who have gone into season two with great joy, it revolves around this house and this society and these people working towards the war effort and turning this grand English men into a hospital. And that, in fact, did happen at the time of World War I. So there's elements of it that are true. However, there are elements of it that aren't quite as true. The charming, happy marriage that the fifth count and countess enjoyed, as told here in this book, was a little bit more of, shall we say, a little bit more of a fiction. But it's a fiction that certainly serves the interests of all of the people who were interested in selling Downton Abbey.
Okay, now we have a book that in some ways is the most interesting. It's called Below Stairs, and the subtitle here is valuable. It's the classic kitchen maid's memoir that inspired Upstairs, Downstairs, and Downton Abbey by Margaret Powell. And as you point out in your very elegant essay, when we see the world through the beloved help, they're not always loving the people they work for so much in return.
They are not loving the people. And this book really holds up. It was originally published in 1968. And it was the first book to really look at what it was like to be downstairs, which is why Upstairs, Downstairs was essentially based on it. And there are some wonderful phrases in this book and some wonderful moments where Margaret Powell talks about, for example, Christmas in these houses where the help had to line up and the people who lived there had on their best social welfare smiles and were giving with such great largesse presents that actually nobody wanted. But she...
And they knew that, right?
They knew that. What's fascinating about her book is she really dissected how the underclasses were supposed to be the moral ones. If you have money, you were above morality. If you didn't have money, well, heaven forfend, heaven betide you if you slipped in any kind of way, which is why there was great regulation of everything from wearing makeup, which the help was not allowed to do, to stepping out with a man. You were essentially expected to be single until the day you left service.
And in fact, as one of the episodes in the second season describes, and as you mentioned in your discussion of this memoir, mm-hmm. if a maid servant, an attractive maid servant, is impregnated by one of the aristocrats living in the house, she pays the price and he doesn't. They would actually just toss her out.
Oh, whoever she was impregnated by, it didn't even matter if it was a farm boy, if it was anybody. The very fact that this moral turpitude was evident to everybody meant that she was gone. Margaret Powell writes about this just wonderfully. It's the most simple but eloquent book. And she went on, this book in 68 was a big bestseller, and she went on to write many books about her time there. And she essentially escaped from service by marriage, which is what many people did, and then by philosophy. She actually began taking courses and decided that she would have an education once her children were grown. And that's what she did.
Okay, now let's ask a sort of meta question here. So we have these very well-to-do patricians or aristocrats mm-hmm. really living the life they choose and enforcing this very strict morality on the people who serve them. And everybody knows it's a fiction. Why are they doing this? Why do these rich people need the poor ones who serve them to act better than they do? What is there a kind of class calibration going on? Or is it keeping them down? Is it making them feel better about themselves?
Well, I mean, even Oscar Wilde wrote about this, saying that the whole purpose of the lower classes were to be the bearers of moral responsibility. He wrote about it in a joking way, in The Importance of Being Earnest, but it was absolutely true. And it's just that money... Is it really any different than today at all? Money gives us license. And in the days before non-disclosure agreements, what was going on in the upper classes was simply the help and the servants were invisible, so that there was no need to even worry about somebody going to the non-existent National Enquirer to tattle about what you were up to. So it was simply the sense that if you didn't have money and you didn't have class or status, you could at least be good.
Now, what is the attraction, do you think, for program in a world like this to us today? Is it that it's similar to our own world, or that it sort of reflects it in some way that gives us a distance on it? Why do we like all of this?
Well,
there's nostalgia
there are,
for
there
these
are, there
people.
There are a few things. I mean, first of all, what we have to recognize is that whenever anybody has an English accent, whatever it is you're listening to is edifying. So we can listen to these shows without any kind of shame because they're all British. We don't have to think of ourselves as listening to soap operas. If this thing was set in a hospital in Detroit someplace, we'd all be in trouble. But it's not. So English accents. Having said that, there's another huge part of this, which is that we look with great wistfulness on a time period and an era where people are born as they die, where we don't have to apologize for the lack of social mobility. Because I think in this country, this Oprah mad country where everybody is constantly trying to self-actualize and where we're being told by all of our Republican nominees that if you don't make money, if you're not wealthy, there's something wrong with you. Well, we look at a culture where people really didn't have those options, and we find a great comfort in it. And I think that's always been true of these kind of costume dramas.
Thanks so much, Judith.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tannenhaus.
That's Judith Newman, who reviews three books on Downton Abbey in this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World by best-selling author Michael Lewis. The Times' Machiko Kakutani says no one writes with more narrative panache about money and finance than Lewis. That's Boomerang by Michael Lewis. It's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So you're back from Palo Alto, where you wrote a very long, great story on Barnes & Noble. And Barnes & Noble is back in the news again. What's going on?
Well, only a few days after our Sunday business story on Barnes & Noble, Barnes & Noble has stayed in the news by announcing this week that they will not sell books published by Amazon. Now, as you know, Amazon has been slowly building its publishing imprints over the last few years. They've made an especially dramatic move last year by hiring Larry Kirschbaum, who is a very well-known guy in the publishing industry, and they've hired Larry to lead their New York unit of Amazon publishing. Now, the big question was, will Barnes & Noble stock these books in their stores?
Right. Amazon, the giant book retailer, went into the book publishing business itself. And we're not talking just about self-published Kindle books. These are physical books, some of them by quite well-known authors, for which Amazon paid quite large advances. And they need to sell these books, irony of ironies, in brick-and-mortar bookstores. Is that right?
That's right. Amazon is playing like a regular publisher. They're acquiring books that would not be out of place at Random House or Simon & Schuster. A few recent examples include a memoir by Penny Marshall of Laverne and Shirley. They acquired a novel by James Franco. They acquired a book by Timothy Ferris, who is a self-help guru. These are all books that were shopped around to other publishers, and the authors chose Amazon.
So why would Barnes & Noble elect not to sell them? What's the thinking there?
The main thinking is that Barnes & Noble has no interest in helping out its biggest competitor sell books. Barnes & Noble, still by far the largest bookseller in the country. They have more than 700 stores, and they operate in 50 states. And Barnes & Noble put out a very sharp statement this week saying basically that they disagreed with Amazon's push for exclusivity. Amazon, as you know, has pushed for exclusive deals with its authors. And Barnes & Noble said it's very clear to us that Amazon has proven that they would not be a good publishing partner to us, and they're pulling content off the market for their own self-interest.
Now, when you say exclusivity, what do you mean? I mean, Amazon clearly wants its author's book sold in other bookstores. Where does the exclusive part come in?
Well, a lot of books that Amazon has acquired, ebooks, especially books that are just going to be online, they have not offered for sale to Barnes & Noble, for instance. So if you publish a Kindle single, which is the short form ebook that Amazon has published, it's a long running series, those books are not for sale on BNN.com for your Nook, for instance.
So Barnes & Noble is fighting back. And how has Amazon reacted to this counter move by its big competitor?
So far, they have said absolutely nothing. They didn't respond to reporters who reached out to them for comment, including this reporter. And everyone is sort of wondering what they're going to do next. It's not clear what they could do to retaliate. Maybe they're just thinking about it and deciding what they're going to do. But so far, it's been silent. There's been a lot of gleeful reaction from publishers behind the scenes because, of course, they're delighted that Barnes & Noble has done what they would love to do, which is strike back at Amazon.
Right. Here's something, Julie, that is confusing to someone like me, and it probably is to a lot of our listeners as well, is the publishers depend very heavily on Amazon as a bookseller, an online bookseller. I believe they're now, you know, the biggest of all booksellers in the world. But they also see Amazon as really threatening them through these their own publication programs. So Amazon is kind of getting them in two ways, and the publishers feel overwhelmed by this giant.
They do. I mean, I think that they see Amazon as a very good customer of theirs, a retailer that sells a lot of books, but they also suspect that Amazon would be very happy if they were all out of business. Amazon is trying to undermine them. Now, what Barnes & Noble did this week could seriously undermine Amazon's efforts to sign up authors who want to see their books in bookstores. You know, if you're an author and you're deciding between Simon & Schuster and Amazon as your publisher, and if it's important to you to see your book on that front table in Barnes & Noble, then maybe you'll end up with Simon & Schuster.
Well, this will be interesting to follow in the days ahead. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Too happy tonight.
You seem so strange. So deep and far away. So you were holding something back.
I am.
Don't.
Even in death, the great Elizabeth Taylor continues to haunt us. There's a new book. It's called, get this, The Accidental Feminist, How Elizabeth Taylor Raised Our Consciousness and We Were Too Distracted by Her Beauty to Notice. It's by a very good journalist and critic, M.G. Lord, and it's reviewed by a really excellent critic and journalist, Liesl Schillinger, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Liesl.
Hi, Sam.
All right, so how does M.G. Lord make the case that Elizabeth Taylor, married a zillion times, sporting the biggest diamond rings in the history of humanity, was actually a feminist?
The fun thing about this book is that she says that she doesn't necessarily think Elizabeth Taylor thought she was herself or knew she was herself. But what she shows, which is kind of fun to go along with M.G. Lord on this ride, is that Elizabeth Taylor did such larger-than-life, larger-than-typical restrained womanhood roles on the screen that it's more like she embodied a larger, freer kind of femininity than she was even aware she was doing.
Okay, so give me some examples. What are the roles she talks about? When was she at – when was Taylor at her peak as a screen goddess, does Lord say, or would you say?
Yeah, no, she certainly says so. Well, you really would go, I guess, from about 1956 when she did – no, you'd go earlier. You'd do A Place in the Sun.
I love that film, 1951, American Tragedy.
It's a George Stevens-directed film, and he took it from Dreiser, and the Hays Code people were really big in censoring, big at censorship. They didn't want the word abortion to come up in the movie or even the idea of it, the suggestion to come up. But this was definitely a play, if you've read the Dreiser novel, that is dealing with this.
Okay, Liesl, so we mentioned abortion. It's not Elizabeth Taylor. It's Shelley Winters, sort of
right.
The discarded other woman,
right.
Who is impregnated.
Tripp.
Yes, mm-hmm. Impregnated by Montgomery Clift. And how did this become such an issue in that film? Why?
Well, the big thing is this was a sensitive subject for the early 1950s, and George Stevens, the director, thought that the only way that we could sympathize with the Montgomery Clift character was to have someone like Elizabeth Taylor. Now, let me backtrack. This movie is about a young man who falls in love with a gorgeous woman he thinks is completely out of his league, but then his rich uncle kind of takes him on, adopts him, and gives him a job at his factory on the ground floor. On the ground floor, the young boy sort of starts going out with a young woman played by Shelley Winters, who's just a nice working-class girl who loves him, and he gets her pregnant. Well, then he discovers he could have had that girl he thought was out of his league all along, and her name is Angela Vickers, and she's played by Elizabeth Taylor, and she is so glitteringly beautiful, so much what every person would strain to have in his life, that the viewer can see why he's tempted to kill the woman he's accidentally impregnated.
And it's worth pointing out for those of our listeners who have not seen this film, I believe Pauline Kael said about Elizabeth Taylor in A Place in the Sun is, when you watch this film, you can really believe this is the single most beautiful young woman on the planet.
Oh, yes. And, you know, when George is having his tryst with the factory girl and thinking of Angela, this flashing neon sign says Vickers, Vickers, Vickers in the California skyline outside his window. And you can just feel his obsession with this woman who's the paragon of perfection.
And what about some of the other films? Suddenly,
well,
Last Summer.
That's something that I talk about in the piece. To appreciate M.G. Lord's book, you really ought to cue up some of these old Elizabeth Taylor movies, because as she points out, anyone under 50 probably hasn't seen them, and they're worth seeing, and they're very potent and very peculiar. And the most peculiar of all of them, I would say, is, in fact, Suddenly Last Summer, which is based on a Tennessee Williams play, and Gore Vidal rewrote it for the movie. And in it, Elizabeth Taylor plays a gorgeous young woman whose crazy rich aunt, played by Katharine Hepburn, wants her lobotomized, because Elizabeth Taylor, her niece, was away in Europe with the rich woman's son and realized that the son was gay and came to a sordid end. And to make her niece forget this, she wants her lobotomized. The doctor who she wants to do it is played by Montgomery Clift. But the movie is filmed black and white. It looks like the Twilight Zone. It's haunting. You have never seen Kate Hepburn looking crazier. She's walking as if she were made of marble covered in white paste through this sort of dangerous garden she has that has Venus flytraps in it. It's spooky.
Okay, so now we get to Lord's argument. She is watching these really larger-than-life cinematic performances by Elizabeth Taylor. She's become this kind of woman. And where do we get the jump from there to a kind of, in her phrase, accidental feminism?
She would say, she being M.G. Lord would say, was that that movie did a huge amount to show that women are bullied by the health system and by the mental health system, and that Elizabeth's crime, or Kathy's crime in the movie, was just being so distractingly gorgeous that just people, everyone thought they owned a piece of her. And there's a disturbing scene when she's put in a mental asylum by her aunt. When running from the doctor, she ends up in the men's ward, walking on a kind of catwalk. And these crazy men come grabbing up at her ankles. It's terrifying. And M.G. Lord feels that that's kind of what was happening to Elizabeth Taylor throughout her life and our culture. Everyone was grabbing at her. She couldn't be ignored, even if she was not trying to do anything. She herself was just too confrontational in herself.
Now, does Lord talk it much or at all about Taylor's personal life, or is she just looking at the films?
Oh, she goes all the way through her personal life. Elizabeth Taylor was married 8 times, twice to the same man, Richard Burton, of course. She broke up several marriages. The love of her life was a man named Mike Todd, who died in a plane crash, unfortunately. I guess Richard Burton is also a second love of her life, but she goes into that, but she doesn't try to tar her with it. She's just showing a woman who is living her life by her own spontaneous rules. And I think she feels that that's a feminist example, too. A movie that for M.G. Lord is really feminist is the movie that won Elizabeth Taylor her first Oscar, and it's called Butterfield 8. It's about a woman who's a call girl, but whose innovation is that she only sees the men that she chooses. And that's considered an absolute breakthrough. So the shock of this movie isn't that Elizabeth Taylor is playing a prostitute. It's that prostitute chooses her own sexual partners, which, as M.G. Lord points out, is what any woman in today's world, even a rather nice girl, does in today's college campuses. But so that was a breakthrough, and she got her first Oscar for that movie.
And, Liesl, one other great performance many will remember is Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Is there a feminist argument
that
there
as well? That was her second Oscar win. Yes, M.G. Lord's argument there is that that movie takes down the patriarchy and shows how it's a smothering, suffocating force that destroys not only women whose intellects are suppressed, but men who can't grow as fully as they can because of the sexist world around them. So I think her case is fairly persuasive, but you kind of need to have those movies in your mental screensaver as you read it to know what she's talking about. I should also here mention the movie Giant, which was pretty incredible. Rock Hudson asked for Elizabeth Taylor to be cast as his co-lead in that movie, and she had recently done A Place in the Sun. But if you've never seen Giant, which many of you probably have, it's a sprawling Western epic where she goes from age 18 to about 70, from a debutante to a grandmother, and has some very powerful, assertive feminist lines, accusing her husband and of his men in Texas of being a bunch of cavemen who should be wearing clubs. So, and she also confronts racial stereotypes. Her son, in the movie, played by Dennis Hopper, marries a Mexican girl. And so this movie was very forward in being for not only liberation of women, but for freedom from race prejudice as well. And that's a feminist point that M.G. Lord makes in this book, that a hallmark of feminism is that feminists also advance progressive causes for other people, not only for women.
Thank you, Liesl.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Liesl Schillinger, regular contributor to the Book Review, who this week reviews The Accidental Feminist by M.G. Lord. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Right. Well, on the nonfiction side of things, the best-selling new title on the hardcover list is Susan Cain's Quiet, which is subtitled The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking.
How high up is that on the list?
That's at number 4.
Wow, that book is really taken off.
Well, who buys books? Introverts.
I suppose introverts. Right.
Cain is an introvert herself. She used to get nauseous when she knew that she'd have to answer questions as a Harvard Law student. And she argues that because they don't assert themselves, introverts are undervalued in American society. She's also been doing a lot of media to promote this book. And on her website, she talks about how counterintuitive it is for an introvert to go on book tour.
Yes, I can imagine. At the same time, she may be introverted in person, but she's writing all over the place. She's done a number of things for the Sunday Review here at the paper, including some fairly long pieces, it seems.
Yeah, she's pretty accomplished. And she talks about how introverts can work to, you know, get ahead in a world that favors extroversion, how they can either fake being extroverted or how they can go to places that value introverted qualities. She also talks about how parents need to pay more attention to their introverted children and make sure that they don't overlook them.
So what examples does she give of the sort of places you might go that value introversion, like our business, journalism, maybe not so much? Or?
You know what? In fact, I know Judith Warner's review, which is in the same issue, Judith Warner criticizes her for not looking enough at places like science labs or other areas where introverts fit in perfectly well and are valued for being introverts.
But not strip clubs, I'm just guessing.
Right.
What else have we got?
At number 8 on the nonfiction list is Fairy Tale Interrupted by Rosemarie Terenzio, which is a memoir of her years as John Kennedy Jr.'s personal assistant and confidant. She met him in 1994. She worked as a publicist at the PR firm whose owner went into business with JFK Jr. To start George Magazine. And so she moved over at that time to become his personal assistant and stayed with him until he died in that 1999 plane crash.
And what did she say about him?
She really liked him. At first, she thought he was an arrogant, entitled jerk. I think she continued to think that. She got fed up with him a lot, and they had this kind of push and pull, love-hate relationship that settled into kind of a big brother, little sister thing. She told The Observer, the New York Observer, back in 2003, that he used to come behind her and like stick gum in her hair, that kind of thing, that they had this kind of jokey relationship. But she...
So he had the Kennedy wit.
if you can call it that.
How about fiction?
We're not done with nonfiction
yet,
if
okay.
You can believe it. At number 10 is Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor with strategic vision, which is a kind of prescription for American foreign policy as global politics shift to China and the East. And then at number 13 is All In by Paula Broadwell, which is an in-depth biography of General David Petraeus. Broadwell is a former Army officer herself and an expert on counterterrorism and counterinsurgency. And she really explores Petraeus' education and his strategic thinking.
I saw somewhere on a fairly serious-minded conservative listserv that Petraeus' name is kicking around as the ideal Republican presidential nominee.
You know, the generals always are. That was the case with Colin Powell, of course. I mean, I guess going back to Eisenhower, everyone always wants the big strategic five-star general to step into the Republican race.
Maybe he's got the answers. Okay, what about fiction?
On the fiction hardcover list, a couple of veterans return this week after bouncing around the extended list for a while.
Not military veterans like
No, best-selling veterans. You've got A Dance with Dragons by George R. R. Martin back on the list at number 12. And Paula McLean's Paris Wife about Hadley Hemingway comes back in at number 14 for the first time since October. It's hitting the list. There were three new titles. At number 13, you have Pineapple Grenade by Tim Dorsey. He writes these comic mysteries set in Florida along the lines of like Carl Hiaasen, only goofier, more madcap. And in this book, his bumbling heroes somehow become spies. Then at number 9, you have a vampire romance novel by Lara Adrian, Darker After Midnight, which continues a popular paperback series, but it's her first hardcover publication. It enters the list at number 9. Finally, Robert Crace debuts at number 1 with his new Elvis Cole Joe Pike mystery, Taken. This series has a huge following. Crace has made the list 9 times so far, and on Yahoo, his fans call themselves the Crazies.
Really? And is this guy good?
Yeah, he actually is. The series is set in a noirish, hard-boiled Los Angeles. It's very much got a kind of Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett feel to it. He idolizes those guys. He wrote the introduction when the Mystery Writers brought out a reissue of The Maltese Falcon. They went to him to write the introduction to that. He lives in Los Angeles, and Hollywood has come courting before, but he told the Baltimore Sun a few years ago that he has no interest in seeing the books turned into movies. He said he really likes Elvis Cole as a character, but he likes him in books. He wouldn't want to see him on the screen. He did say that he pictures Elvis Cole, who's his private eye hero, as a kind of Michael Keaton-ish character.
Michael Keaton, there's a name for
the past. Said he got hammered for that. His readers all said, oh, no. And he's like, what? I think Michael Keaton's a good actor.
Well, maybe he is.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.